That scene, however many times it's recounted, if you really picture it, is so thrilling. Then cometh Mary Magdalene to the sepulchre. As soon as the dawn was there, they'd been prohibited by the rituals and the Passover. They couldn't, the Sabbath, they couldn't deal with Jesus' body as they had wanted to. But at the first light of dawn, as soon as the prohibition was lifted, she ran to the rock. You have earlier the scene of Jesus being on the cross, and so many of his disciples were so frightened by the unexpected events of him being arrested and taken in front of the rabble and condemned to death and to die, that so many of the disciples just ran away. They didn't know what to do. Even Peter, who had been so steadfast, as Christ predicted at the Last Supper, three times Peter was asked, "Are you a disciple of this master?" "No," Peter says, "I never knew him." Imagine that. Peter had left everything and given his life to be Christ's disciple. And then there, once all of their expectations of Jesus' power, because they felt the power in him, his disciples knew who he was. They had left everything for reason, for good reason, for their intuitive perception of who he was. And it was a power they knew that was much more powerful than kings and princes and mere politicians or the priests in the temple. They knew Christ had that kind of power. They had defied all those authorities to follow him. And yet, suddenly it happens. At the Garden of Gethsemane, the cohort comes to arrest Jesus. Peter's response is to fight. Peter takes out his sword and he whacks off the ear of one of those who's trying to take his master away. Christ himself stops Peter, and then, in such a wonderful way, Christ puts the ear back on, fixes the ear. It's like, oh no, this wasn't supposed to happen. We wind it back, we put it back on. There's another wonderful story like that. I'm going to digress in this exciting story of Jesus. There's the story of St. Paul, who was apparently quite long-winded when he talked. As a public speaker, this story is dear to my heart. Paul was giving a lecture to a great crowd, and great numbers had come to hear him, and the room was full to capacity, and so full that the people were sitting on the windowsills, and it was a warm night, and the windows were thrown open, and Paul talked and talked and talked and talked, and it got very late, and some poor lad sitting on the windowsill fell asleep, fell out the window, hit the sidewalk and died, hit the ground and died, okay? So Paul has literally talked him to death. So Paul rushes out and resurrects him from the dead. It was one of Paul's great miracles, is that he resurrected the man that he had killed. They sort of pass over that. That's my, I always say to the other speakers, you must stay within the allotted time unless you're capable of resurrecting your listeners. Otherwise, you must be loyal to the time that's given to you. But back to Jesus. He's in the Garden of Gethsemane, and this crowd comes, and he's going to be taken by the cohort. This in itself, you see, is not frightening to the disciples, because there's many incidents throughout the Bible in which Jesus confronts these powerful forces, whether it's the Pharisees or the Sanhedrin or one of these great powers from the temple or worldly powers. Many different times they've tried to arrest him. Sometimes Jesus has essentially dematerialized, just somehow disappeared. They weren't able to find him. So when this cohort comes to arrest him, it's not as if the disciples expect it to be different than it has been before. Now, if they'd been listening intuitively, Christ has been trying to tell them for quite some time. The whole saga of the period of time between Palm Sunday and when he is taken is Christ saying goodbye to his disciples. But such things are clearer in retrospect than they are at the time. Swami Kriyananda talks about the time on March 7th, 1952, when Paramhansa Yogananda left his body, his Mahasamadhi, it's called in the Indian tradition, which is the final great samadhi from which you never return. You never re-inhabit the body after that. Yogananda knew that that was going to be his last night, March 7th. He knew that he was going to give this speech and die just as Yogananda had predicted. He said, "I want to die with my boots on," is how he said, speaking of my beloved India and my beloved America. And there was a banquet for that he was invited to, honoring the Indian ambassador to America. And Yogananda gave an after-dinner speech and recited his poem, My India. And then he talked about how much he loved India. First, he talked about the unity of India and America, which you see happening all over the world right now, very interestingly. He talked about the unity of these two great countries. Then he paid tribute to his land of birth. And then he said the word sod. That was the last word. My body is hallowed. I am hallowed. My body touched that sod, Yogananda declares. And then as Swami writes it, the word sod became a sigh. And he fell over. He just stopped his heart and left his body at that point. And people started crying out. Kriyananda was sitting there. People started crying out, Master has fainted. And Swamiji said he was a playwright in his aspirations before he got on the spiritual path. And his immediate thought was, no, it's too perfect. This is the end of his life. And then, of course, the disciples all looked back and they saw in how many ways Master had been saying goodbye. Just over and over. So Christ said goodbye to his disciples. He didn't want to just leave them there, but it was more like he planted it in them. Even with Peter, he was saying, I'm going to a place, Jesus said at the Last Supper, I'm going to a place where you can't follow me. Peter, who was very enthusiastic, said, Oh Lord, I'll go with you anywhere. Christ looked at him and said, Ah, before the dawn comes, you will deny three times that you even knew me. Now, on one hand, that's somewhat brutal to say, but you see, then when Peter actually fulfilled his master's promise, he could realize that he'd been forgiven in advance. You see how sweetly Christ did that? And in all these ways, he planted this thought. But when he was taken, and every step of the way, when he was in the hands of those guards, when he was being jeered by the mob, when he was in front of Pontius Pilate, at every moment, the disciples kept expecting that he was going to be, that he was going to declare himself, and by the power he had, he was going to escape from this worldliness, from this completely inappropriate suppression of his light by these gross and terrible people. But he didn't. Inwardly, he was unmoved. And you have those magnificent scenes between him and Pontius Pilate, in which Pontius Pilate essentially says to Jesus, beg for your life. And Jesus won't even answer him or just looks to the heavens and speaks of his heavenly Father. Pontius says, are you a king? He said, not of this world. Nothing of this world matters to me. But then he goes and he's put on the cross. And even to the last moment, now only Mary, his mother, and Mary Magdalene, and John, the disciple whom Jesus loved. That's how John refers to himself. They were there at the foot of the cross. And then Jesus expires. He just ceases to breathe. And it's over. He's gone. And they take him. Joseph of Arimathea gets permission. They take him down. Even though normally they leave the bodies hanging there as an example to others, they got permission to take Jesus down. And you have this beautiful scene described where Jesus' mother sits at one hand and has his head in her lap. And Mary of Magdalene is at the other end and has his feet like this. But this is just the body now. Where is the spirit? And the Sabbath is approaching, so they put this body, they wrap it in the winding sheets, and they don't prepare it properly because the sun is setting, the Sabbath is starting, they can't do it. They put it in the tomb, they close the rock. The priests put guards in front of it because there have been rumors that miracles might happen and they don't want someone to steal the body and then claim it's been resurrected. So they put guards in front of it and then they have to go away. And you can imagine Mary just counting the hours, watching the sun, waiting for this to happen. And finally, at the first moment, she rushes to the tomb. And now an even further indignity has taken place because the body is gone. And she turns. And she sees an angel, a figure in white. And this is just, the Bible is full of humor. She thinks it's the gardener. You know, like the masters have this capacity to cloud our minds. And she says, they've taken away the Lord. Do you know where he is? He says, Mary. And she realizes suddenly that it's Christ and he's risen. And then he says, go and tell the others. And so she rushes to tell them and they don't believe her. But you can see they can be forgiven for not believing her. She just, it was hard to say. She's so extreme in her excitement. I have seen him, he has risen. And others, then they come running with her and they look and the tomb is empty. No one knows what to think. Then the disciples are gathered, and they're gathered in a closed room, a locked room, they say, for fear of the very ones who took Jesus away may come for them also. But Swamiji makes the most and one of the most important points of the whole story is that, you see, they still had faith in Jesus because they came together. If they had lost that faith, they wouldn't have come together. And because they had that faith, even though they were frightened and they were terribly confused. Now, you see, there's so many lessons in this story of Jesus' life. And the fact that the disciples came together behind a locked door is also part of it, because we are not the master, we are the disciples. What do we do when a test is given to us that defies all our expectations, that defies all our logic, all our reason, everything that those disciples knew and understood about how Christ's life was supposed to be, had all of it been defied, and now even the body was gone. They just didn't know what to think about it, but still, they couldn't abandon what they had become. Because even though now they were walking in darkness, they were walking literally in fear of their lives, they could not repudiate the experience that they had had of the divine truth of this man and the truths behind him, beyond him. They knew it was true, even though nothing in their present experience made any sense to them. Have you been there? Have you been in that reality where step by step you suddenly find yourself in a position enduring a test, being asked to give up something or to accept something or live without something or live with something? It all depends on which way God wants to strengthen us. And it's so far beyond anything we expected. We have our ideas about how these things work. We know I do these things, and we get involved in these dogmatic religions that tell you if you do this, then this will happen, or we get raised to be good little whatever we're going to be, and you behave in a certain way, and then good things will happen to you, and then they don't, right? They don't. Someone betrays you, your health betrays you, your body betrays you. I don't have to make the list. Time passes. I remember it was so touching to me the first time I visited my mother-in-law's house, because David's life has gone in a direction that wasn't exactly what his parents anticipated. As a good Jewish boy, they're not exactly proud of him for doing this. but they should be. Maybe now that they're in the astral world, they are. They didn't quite know how to relate to it, let's just put it that way. And so I went to his parents' house, and she had beautiful portraits of each of her three children when they were 8 years old. And she had a few other little pictures, but what she had was the time when they belonged to her. And she was a good mother, they were good parents. They did a good job, you know? But the time when they belonged to her, they were children. I can remember my own father literally with tears in his eyes when he realized that I was just going to go off and live my life. He said, "The child disappears into the adult. And you still have someone, but you don't have the one you had." And it's not that that childhood isn't lovely. It's just the problem with it is, like everything else in life, it's evanescent. You think it's going to last forever, but it doesn't. And it's not because God doesn't love us or want us to be happy. It's just this is the nature of the material world. The material world is flux. It's up today, it's down tomorrow, it's youth today, it's old age tomorrow. Every single thing in this creation comes in pairs, and those pairs are opposites, because it's one vast ocean, and it's just waves going up and down and up and down, and it never affects the ocean. The ocean is never perpetually up or perpetually down. It's the depth of the ocean, and this happens on the surface of it. So those disciples are there, but they had the faith to come together in the belief that even if it was all dark and it didn't make any sense anymore, they knew what they had. And because of that, Jesus appeared in the midst of them. They're inside a room with the door locked, and Jesus appears in the midst of them. And what does he say? "Peace be unto you." In other words, all agitation, all fear. I know what you've been through, my children. Jesus loved them. I know what you've been through, but you see, all of it was just an illusion. It just ends in peace. Now, Christianity is an extremely challenging religion. The life of Christ is very challenging. There's very few avatars, and perhaps this is the only one, whose life is so challenging. And not only that, but the instructions are, walk where I walked. Pick up your cross and follow me. He who is not willing to pick up his cross and follow me is not worthy of me. Even the foxes have holes that they call their own, but the Son of Man has nothing. Go forth, take with you not a spare cloak, not a scrap of food, not a piece of money. Depend on God in all ways. It's really the most renunciate religion and the most guru-oriented religion. It's really extremely Eastern. Is what it really is. This is the great irony of the whole thing. There's no more guru-oriented religion in the world than Christianity, because it's all based on this understanding that this great soul came, and he is the light. He showed us the way. And we have to look at the crowning event of his life was his crucifixion, his arrest, his torture, his crucifixion, and his resurrection. Not for the grief it caused, but for the example it shows of how we ourselves must live. The way Swamiji puts it is very simple. He said, life is a very... The lesson of this is two things. Our willingness to accept with courage whatever God gives us, and our unremitting faith that if we follow through courageously, that there is light at the end. The wisdom to understand that that is the nature of life. I was reflecting this morning on the subject of death, which I've joked with you all that I like the subject of death. It's always been a very nice subject to me. I think I lived in those monasteries where you had a human skull on your desk, you know, and you would drink out of the human skull. I mean, it sounds very morbid, doesn't it? When I was young and I would read about Sri Ramakrishna in India and how he would go to the, in India, yogis often go to the cremation grounds. You know, here when someone dies, it's all sort of taken away and hidden, and the mortuary takes care of it, and then the body reappears or is cremated. In India, when someone dies, the family comes together, they wash the body, they put the body on a litter, the male members of the family. You'll just be walking along or in a bus somewhere, and especially in more traditional areas, you'll just see a whole procession of people with some dead relative wrapped in a winding sheet, and they're just walking down to the river to the cremation grounds. You see this especially in Varanasi, which is smaller. And then the family gathers there, and they put a big pile of logs, and they put the body right on it, and the oldest son lights it, and then they all just stand there and watch the body burn. It's really very, very different than here. And American tourists get in little boats, and we ride our little boats on the Ganges, and we just sit there and we look like this. You know, it's really something to see. And it's thrilling to me somehow. And yogis make it a deliberate practice of go to the cremation grounds. And then Master did it when he was a young boy. He would go to the cremation grounds near where his house was in Calcutta. And he would just sit there and he would meditate while the bodies would come and the bodies would burn. Now, it's not at all morbid, because it's not merely that we're talking about the death of the physical body. Every single moment of life is change. The death of the physical body is just the biggest one of what's been happening from the very beginning. Every single day is a different day. Just as I was speaking about dear Esther Praver enshrining the pictures of her children when they were younger, I mean, she's living out the fact that this used to be and now something else is here. And her thought was a little bit more toward that side than toward the present. She could relate to it more easily than to the present. But all of our lives, I remember one of the statements of Swami Kriyananda that just stuck in my mind so strongly, very early on the path. He said, the only certainty in life is change. Most people resist change. That's why they suffer. I mean, it's about as simple as that, isn't it? Almost every time you think you're suffering because circumstances are different than they were before. And maybe you like the other circumstances better, and then we're all foolish enough, after millions of incarnations, you wonder how he could be so dumb. But there's this power, and they call it in India, they call it Maya. Maya is the enchantress, the magician, and she sort of casts this spell over us. So we think this time it'll be different. That's why we reincarnate so many times. Yes, of course, this time I did accidentally marry the wrong person, and so I was unhappy because of that, but next time I'll marry the right person, and then it'll work. Well, this time I married the right person, but we lived in the wrong city, and then my mother-in-law was really a terror, and that didn't work. So the next time I'll marry this person, and then we'll live in the right city, and then I'll have a different mother-in-law, but this time we didn't have any children, so this time we'll, you know, and then this time I got the child, but boy, was he a lemon, so I'm gonna try again, and I'll get this one. You know? And so we just come back and back and back thinking that somehow on this planet, we're going to get it to finally stay still. Right? Finally stay still. This time. Got it all set up. I mean, it's ridiculous. But we do it continuously, don't we? I mean, really continuously for a really long time. Okay? The reason that Christ chose death to show us is he's trying to say there's no change. There's nothing that can be taken away from you, not even what you call yourself, that doesn't have light behind it, that doesn't have light on the other side of it. And our problem, and the reason we go through these experiences over and over again, is because we're not wise. We don't have the wisdom to just see life for what it is. It's not good or bad, it's not even that it's not beautiful. And it's not that we can't enjoy it, but what we enjoy is the inner presence of God. And we enjoy the fact that, oh, look how beautiful it is when there's a newborn baby and the mother takes that baby in her arms and it's such a miracle of life. And those little children are so sweet. I watched a friend of mine once from a great distance. He had a beautiful little daughter, and I was at Ananda Village, and I was sitting on a hill. I was about 500 yards away. He was over there. This beautiful little child was over here. This little child goes, "Daddy!" like this, races the whole distance and leaps into his arms. I mean, I was just weeping. It was so beautiful to see. I thought to myself, how could you not become attached to that? I hadn't yet met my mother-in-law. I hadn't met my husband. But how could you not become attached to that? But you see, she turns 14 and she says "Daddy" with a very different tone of voice. And it breaks his heart. It breaks his heart. One of the most poignant memories of my life is my father weeping in front of me, because he and I were very close when I was a child, but when I grew up, I just walked away. I didn't love him less, but my life was not meant to be with him. And I just remember him weeping. "It's so hard," he said. And I mean, I had to just shut my heart to it. I couldn't deal with it. And even still, I pray for him many times because I see it. But what should he have done? Well, what he should have done and what he will do eventually, and what that pain will teach him, is not that he should have loved his daughter less. The daughter needs to be loved. I often think with gratitude how deeply grateful I am for my father, because he loved me so profoundly. I have such wonderful memories of being his daughter. But he depended on me for his happiness. And I couldn't allow that. I couldn't live that. And nor was that the truth, you see. It wasn't that he was wrong to love me, but he was wrong to depend on me for his happiness. That wasn't wisdom. So that's what all our tests are in life. It's just one way or another, we're breaking divine law. That's how Master puts it. Karmic tests don't come to us to hurt us. They just come to teach us what karmic law actually is. The nature of this world. Evanescent. But you see, there's a glorious secret behind it. If we only stay there, then it's absolute misery. And we commit suicide or we become drug addicts. And I would endorse it. You know, what else could you do? But you see, that's not the truth. This world is evanescent, but God's love is acting out all the parts. But karmic law plays itself out. These things have to happen. We have to transcend this evanescent world into the eternal world. So here we have this extraordinary example of Christ. And God suffers for us too. In Swami's Bhagavad Gita commentary, he talks about Charles Dickens writing a certain story about this character, Little Nell. Little Nell was such a sympathetic character, and they say that the night that Charles Dickens realized he was writing the novel, that little Nell was going to have to die, or to put it more accurately, that the story demanded that he kill little Nell. He walked the streets of London weeping. This was a fictional character, but the story demanded it. God weeps for us in the same way. Christ stood outside Jerusalem. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, I would have gathered thee under my wings like a mother hen protects her brood, but ye would not have it. God wants to protect us from this suffering of false reasoning, but he can't break his own law. There's no way that the world will recreate itself for us. It simply can't be done. So a power like Christ comes into the world, and he is a window onto the infinite, and he shows. He said, look, I accept with courage, with calmness, even with joy, and with love for all. Father, forgive them. They know not what they do. You see, this is how we live through our tests in the right way. Not inwardly thinking, oh, poor me, what's happening to me? Why is this happening? I'm so good. I do everything just right, and I really wanted it. The energy goes out in kindness and in love and in forgiveness. And then what do we find at the end of that? Peace be unto you.